I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. There is a crisis in the federal government over paying for a Mexican border wall, and 800,000 federal workers are paying the price. Their last pay stub had zeros where the money should be. Congress will be voting on several bills this week to reopen the government, but there is such bad will between the parties and the leadership, it looks like the longest federal government shutdown in history will continue. Last month, President Trump started this crisis when he said, "I am proud to shut down the government for border security. I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down." Today, he blames the Democrats and specifically House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for this standoff. How do we get to this point of political dysfunction and tribal partisanship? Our guests Kevin Cruz and Julian Zelizer believe some of the answers can be found in the 1970s. Their book Fault Lines is based on a class they created at Princeton University, where they both teach history, and they both join us here in our Philadelphia studio. Kevin Cruz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having us.
And Julian Zelizer, thank you for joining us as well.
Great to be here.
We had Joanne Freeman as a guest on Radio Times a couple of months ago. She wrote a book called Field of Blood about fistfights and duels involving members of Congress in the early days of the country. Relatively speaking, are we in a better space than we were back then, Kevin?
Well, you know, no blood has been shed on the floor of Congress right now. What we're getting upset about are, you know, mean words and got the government shut down more seriously. So I guess a little bit better than what Joanne talked about.
But at the same time, we've got 800,000 people who are some working, some not, but are not, Julian. They're not getting paid.
Right. So there's no guns in the chamber for sure. That said, the consequences of what this division is causing are pretty severe. Government does a lot more in this day and age. It employs a lot more people. And so when you're talking a shutdown, you're talking about a big presence in American life that is paralyzed. And so I think that's why we're watching to see how this is resolved and, right. and hoping it's resolved soon.
Why the 1970s? There were obviously, I'm thinking of the resignation of Richard Nixon, the most obvious event of the 1970s, Kevin. But what else was happening during that decade that might help us understand today?
Yeah, there's a series of events that really do shatter the country in a lot of ways across the board. The resignation of Richard Nixon in 1974 is clearly the biggest one. We forget this is a huge shock to the system. A president resigns in the middle of his second term after winning a landslide reelection. In 72, he'd been swept in with a huge victory.
49 states. Right?
Yeah, 49 states. And so this phenomenal victory, and suddenly he's gone less than 2 years later. That's a huge thing. But around it are a series of other shocks, and if you look across the board. So in terms of the economy, 1973, you've got the oil embargo, which really does expose America's reliance on foreign sources of energy. You start to feel the industrial economy start to sputter at the same time. You've got 1973 Roe v. Wade. You've got the busing fights in the early 70s as well on racial lines. In terms of foreign policy, another huge shock is the withdrawal from Vietnam and a sense that America is not quite the mighty superpower it felt like it was. So these things come in rapid succession in 73, 74, 75, and it really does shake the country to its core across the board. And so that's why we chose that moment as the starting point here.
Julian, let me go back to you, because from my perspective, the resignation of Richard Nixon was an example of bipartisanship eventually, and that essentially the system worked, the system helped. A corrupt president was forced to leave office.
Some felt that way, and some were hoping that would be the outcome, that the beginning of the impeachment process, the decision of the president to step down, would create some kind of resolution, not only to his crisis, but to the concerns people had during the 60s about Vietnam, about our political system. It didn't turn out that way. First, the bipartisanship came at the very end. It's important to remember Republicans did stand by the president until they couldn't stand by the president. So till there was a smoking gun tape, many Republicans were defending him, and many thought he would survive, including him. But then there was the smoking gun tape. But even after he resigned, the first story we really tell is the pardon of Richard Nixon by his successor, President Ford. And many people were outraged when he did that, and it quickly ignited the same feelings that had surrounded the presidency. And more important, since 74, a lot of the institutional problems that he exposed have come back in new ways.
Do you think that was a wrong decision? I mean, we're reliving or rewriting history here, Kevin, but do you think, and President Ford at the time said it was more important to hold the country together than to essentially put a former president on trial.
Right.
But do you think that was the right decision?
Well, I think the theories that held up at the time that there was some sort of corrupt bargain, I think that's not correct. I do think Ford was acting in what he thought were sincerely the country's best interest here. He did think the country needed to put what he called the long national nightmare of Watergate behind it. But he did so, I think, too quickly. There was no real reckoning with what Nixon had done. Even some of the people underneath him who went to jail never served full terms. They got out. But Nixon himself did a lot to rehabilitate his image. There's the famous moment in the Nixon-Frost interviews where he says, if a president does it, that means it's not illegal. Well, had we had a trial, we could have put that to the test. And instead, that theory gets floated out there. And the fact that Richard Nixon got off scot-free because of Watergate, I think did a lot to embolden future chief executives. And so I don't think we had quite the accountability for the imperial presidency that we thought we had.
Well, and I wonder, too, if you add Julian Iran-Contra and other – and we've had other scandals, impeachment of Clinton on top of that as we move forward. Does that – do you think the public began to have a different view of government and government leaders?
Well, in the 70s, they did. And even after the pardon, one of the phenomena we write about are all the reforms that take place. So Congress tries to restrain the president. Before Watergate, we have the War Powers Act. We have a budget reform. In 78, people forget we created an independent prosecutor to investigate executive branch corruption, and this would expire in 1999 and not be rehabilitated. So there were efforts to constrain presidential power. But our book is also a chronicle of many presidential scandals where it's clear that even with the reforms, presidents found ways to abuse power. Iran-Contra is an amazing story about
a forgotten story, I would say, in many ways.
Yeah, high-level officials circumventing what Congress explicitly said not to do. Don't give money to the Nicaraguan Contras. And Reagan officials were doing exactly that. And in the end, that scandal happened. It was shocking. But the president himself, Ronald Reagan, didn't suffer by the end of his presidency. He was doing pretty well. So there's been many scandals like that, which I do think erode some of the public confidence in our institutions.
How about Clinton and impeachment? How do you see that, Kevin?
Well, Clinton's impeachment seems to be a little bit different in that he was part of a culture in the look of the 90s, and we have a chapter actually titled Scandalized, which is all about the scandals of the 90s. And what he eventually gets impeached for, basically obstruction of justice and perjury charges around the Monica Lewinsky affair, the underlying spark of that impeachment was actually a fairly minor thing, right? It's not of the scale of Watergate or Iran-Contra. But what that shows are the ways in which the impeachment process is inherently political. I mean, it is a political choice. There's a reason that high crimes and misdemeanors is so vaguely drawn in the Constitution is that it leaves it up to Congress to decide what those are. And that changes with the times. And so in 1986, when there was a clear breaking of the law, a clear subversion of what Congress had done, and what was going on with Iran and what was going on in Nicaragua were both each half of that was bad on its own. You put them together, it was an incredible scandal. But Congress at that time decided that they didn't have a case to make against Reagan. Mm-hmm. All of his subordinates basically fell on their swords for him, and nobody pointed back at Reagan. And so, and I think they were also worried that it was too close to Watergate, that you couldn't impeach a second president in 12 years. It would have really ravaged the country. There's a different calculation that Republicans make in 1998 and 1999. They decide to go for it, and ultimately they pay the price there.
Well, and is it, we should talk about Newt Gingrich and I guess the vast right-wing conspiracy that Hillary Clinton talked about. But, Julian, how do you then see the rise of, I guess, both a political extremism on the one hand, but also a media that seems to work hand in glove?
Well, they're both important. So the political extremism or the creation of a political system where the center doesn't find much of a place is a longstanding process that comes out of the 70s and by the 90s is fully kicking in. Political parties where clearly the best thing to do politically, rationally, is to play to extremist elements. We do argue that this happened in more pronounced fashion with Republicans than Democrats. And it's important to understand the differences in the parties. And the media worked hand in hand. The media also evolved. We move away from the era in the 60s where you had a handful of networks, a handful of city papers, to both a fragmented and constant news cycle. And at the same time, by the mid-90s, when Fox News comes on air, partisan news sources that have great power in terms of scale and scope. And these you can see in the Gingrich years of the mid-90s working hand in hand, including with the Clinton impeachment.
Well, I'm wondering, too, you mentioned abortion. I mean, that there was abortion and then there was the backlash to abortion and this whole notion, Kevin, of family values. Did that, in a sense, define then the Republican Party?
It came to. And it's important, I think, to remember that as much as we take that term for granted, it was an invention. It was an invention of the 1970s. And it's a way for religious conservatives largely to push back against the rising tide of what they see as feminism and gay rights, the unwelcome advances that they see there. And it's a remarkable story because – and it's when we focus on the book. In fact, Phyllis Schlafly is one of the people on the cover because of it. And what Phyllis Schlafly does is she takes this movement, which seems like a runaway freight train, the movement for the Equal Rights Amendment. When it comes out of Congress, there multiple states pass it, ratify it within a day. It just seems obvious to people that you would not discriminate on basis of gender. What Schlafly does is she does a brilliant bit of reframing, and she advances this idea that the Equal Rights Amendment isn't about rights for women. It's rather going to take away rights from women. It's going to take away their right to automatic alimony. It's going to take away their right to automatic custody of children in case of divorce. It's going to take away their right to be taken care of by their husbands. It's going to impose on them new responsibilities. They're going to have to, my God, are they going to have to fight in the military? Are they going to be drafted, right? There's a real pushback against this. And so she says, this isn't about lifting women up. It's about tearing families down. And so the opposition of this, we're not opposed to women's right. We're in favor of family values. And that becomes a touchstone of the conservative movement and certainly the Republican Party from that point on, because Schlafly does this brilliant kind of retail campaigning across the country. While liberals had this confidence that what happened in D.C. is going to roll over the country, Schlafly goes out and works the state houses. And she's got these women who work with her, and there's this group, Stop ERA. The stop stands for Stop Taking Our Privileges, gives you a sense of their framing. And they go out and they literally are bringing baked goods to these state legislators who are mostly men. And they pitch to them, you know, my heart and hand went into this dough for the sake of the family. Please vote no. Right. And it works. They get these states to turn around. And this thing that seemed easy to pass suddenly becomes incredibly controversial. And family values is the key to shaping that.
I do want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Kevin Cruz, who joins us along with Julian Zelizer. They've co-authored a new book. It's called Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. They are both history professors at Princeton University, both joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. Lines open, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. Already coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking about some history to put our current situation into some kind of a context. Do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests about how we became so politically polarized. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a CNN political analyst, and he's co-host of the podcast Politics and Polls. Kevin Cruz is a professor of history at Princeton University as well. And again, their book that they have co-authored called Fault Lines. I do want to ask you, Julian, a question, but first a tweet from Jeremy. He says, listening to your interview now, reading about scandals is interesting. How many bottles of wine do you recommend while reading?
Yes, I recommend something harder.
Or maybe even writing,
maybe
right?
Maybe some whiskey or something. And it is actually a book with, by definition, a lot of conflict, a lot of evidence of the divisions and instability of our country. So it's not always an uplifting read. So if that's the way you deal with something like that, maybe take out a bottle.
Yeah, but don't drive, for
no.
Sure. Kevin was describing how Phyllis Schlafly and the more conservative elements of the country and even of the Republican Party were able to reframe the ERA. Julian, how come the Democrats, the liberals, the progressives didn't have an answer to that.
Well, part of it is conservatism was a fresh movement in the 1970s. It had a lot of the exciting voices. Conservatives were creating new think tanks in Washington, new media outlets, and they just had at the grassroots level a kind of energy Democrats didn't. Democrats were still getting over some of their own divisions from the 60s and some of their own disillusionment in their own leaders like Lyndon Johnson. So I think that's a really important part of the drive and successful drive behind using themes like this. And they also had pretty effective leaders like Ronald Reagan, who in 1980 thought of how to take a theme like that, family values, connect it to anti-communism and tax cuts, and provided a message President Carter wasn't able to match, or Walter Mondale in 1984 wasn't able to match. We do argue, though, that the Democrats don't disappear, and Democrats, liberals are still an important part of this era, and slowly reformulate their answer. It takes time, right, but their answer to some of these questions.
Well, let's then talk about President Obama, who famously said, you know, we are neither red or blue America, we are one America. How did that work out, Kevin?
Not well. Spoiler. I think Obama came to office with a very sincere desire to be the agent of what he called a post-partisan politics, to really move beyond the gridlock. However, and he had some good efforts here. If you think about what he did in those opening months or years of the presidency, he really did bend over backwards, I think liberals would say to a fault, to please the Republicans. He brought two Republicans into his cabinet, tried to get a third until Judd Gregg actually had second thoughts and backed off. That would have set a record for modern era.
Yeah.
Three Republicans in a Democratic cabinet. The stimulus, a third Republican tax cuts, health care based on a Republican idea that Mitt Romney had implemented in Massachusetts, the individual mandate of that is a Heritage Foundation idea. So there are a lot of really I think big signs here that he's reaching across the aisle. What happens, though, is that it's not enough for him to reach across the aisle. That hand has to be accepted on the other side. And instead, it gets slapped away. And it gets slapped away because Mitch McConnell in the Senate and Eric Cantor, largely as the mover in the House, say to their caucuses quite clearly, look, the path to winning back power here is going to be to deny these guys any successes. And what he wants most of all, clearly, are bipartisan progress. And so what we can do to deny him that is simply to hold back our votes. And they're explicit about this. Senator George Voinovich of Ohio later says that McConnell's strategy is whatever Obama was for, we had to be against, period. And it's this reflexive, almost knee-jerk resistance and rejecting whatever Obama wants. And it does succeed. And so Obama gets frustrated, even though they had huge numbers in the Senate at the time. Even though he'd been elected with a giant margin in 2008, it evaporates because it's simply this bipartisan drive keeps breaking against this wall of resistance, and there's nothing he can do about it.
But do you think also, Julian, that Obama was too conservative for a lot of liberals / progressives in the Democratic Party?
Well, that's a critique. So when he puts his stimulus program forward, this is a big source of criticism from liberal economists, from a lot of liberal activists. You need to do much more. Or with health care, in the earlier part of our book, when we're talking about Democratic health care proposals, you're essentially talking about single-payer plans that people like Senator Ted Kennedy were pushing. It whittles down by the time President Clinton tries his health care plan, and then even further. So there is a criticism that by moving to the center, he actually alienated himself or took out some of the energy from his natural supporters. He would say, and kind of after many years in the presidency, that was definitely the best I was going to get. And we're even lucky we have that because I myself have learned just how hardened these partisan divisions are. So I can't settle the debate. Neither of us can. But I think it's an ongoing issue with Democrats right through 2020.
Does that raise the question about gerrymandering? I mean, it used to be the wonkiest question you could ask someone. And now I have to say we've done whole shows about gerrymandering, and the internet goes crazy because people want to talk about it. But is that, in terms of understanding where we are today, do we need to understand gerrymandering?
Absolutely. And again, we've had, you know, gerrymandering goes back to the founding of the Republic, basically. But we've really seen it ramp up in recent years. And the impact of this is that you've increasingly got these districts from the House, which are reliably Republican or reliably Democratic. And what that means in practice is that the people who represent those districts are constantly looking over their shoulder, not at a challenge from the other party, but they're worried they're going to get challenged from the other extreme in their own party. And I think what we see, again, to go back to Eric Cantor, I think he's a perfect example of this. No one provided more resistance to the Obama agenda in the House of Representatives than Eric Cantor. And yet he still wasn't far enough to the right, to escape a primary challenge. He gets beaten by Dave Brat, who runs around from his right. And so there's constantly going to be this pressure. There's nothing you can do that's enough, really, to make these to defend off these primary challenges. And what that does is it forces people further and further to be extremes. Again, I think it's much more pronounced in the Republican Party than the Democratic Party, but I think you're seeing these trends in both.
Mm-hmm. Although I ran across a poll, it's a couple of years old, but nonetheless, I think it was a Pew survey, that most Americans are not uniformly conservative or liberal, which raises the question, yes, we have this partisan politics, but does it represent the American people, Julian?
Well, no, that is it's a criticism often of the red-blue map that, yes, we have that in politics. That's how votes come out. But if you ask people about specific issues from abortion rights to tax cuts, you can often find people in the gray area.
Right.
That said, part of the story since the 70s, especially in the 70s and 80s, is how we remake a lot of our key institutions so that they will favor a more divisive sort of politics. We make in the 70s parties stronger on purpose. We want a more partisan politics. Many people in the country were sick of bipartisan backroom deals and smoke-filled rooms. And so they said we need strong parties with coherent ideas. We empower leaders of Congress through PACs to have the money to make sure everyone votes the same way. We accelerate and put on steroids the redistricting process so that we could make sure districts are solidly red or blue. Or our campaign finance system that comes out of the 70s favors single-issue donor groups that make sure people stay on the party line. And the same is true with the history of the media. So that's part of our story. It's not necessarily about a nation that is divided on every issue. It's about how we developed a country with institutions that fueled those kinds of divisions.
And the institutions are?
The media, the political parties, and the political system. Those are the two big ones. And then we talk about kind of social group conflict, not necessarily the masses, but social groups that are fundamentally divided on issues like race, gay rights, and many other questions.
Do you think Republicans/conservatives are winning this fight, Kevin? I mean, it's interesting to ask that question, knowing, for instance, that there are gay rights now. There's gay marriage now.
I think, and that's maybe a good way to approach this question. So if we look back at the 1980s, the traditional story had been that the Reagan Revolution comes about. It's a true revolution. First of all, as we note in the book, that's a message that they consciously craft up. They want this election to be seen not just as another election, but as a revolution. And they succeed to a lot of ways. They really do convince people that they have changed everything. But they haven't changed everything. There's a certain stickiness to liberal institutions, and there are seeds of new liberal ideas here. And so if you look at gay rights, if you look at the fight against AIDS, the Reagan administration didn't just ignore this. They mocked this issue when it came up. Larry Speaks, the spokesman for the White House, literally laughs off a question about AIDS. Oh, I don't have it. Do you have it? Ha, ha, ha. They're laughing in a White House press conference about this. What happens is that gay and lesbian activists who are finding their communities ravaged by this disease really do speak out on this, and they form their own new organizations. So ACT UP is an important story that we tell in the book. And they are directly confronting, through direct action protest and through major media campaigns, they're confronting this administration that has turned a blind eye to this issue. Finally, they get Reagan to speak out on this, largely because it's finally affected someone he knows, and he takes it seriously when it hits Rock Hudson. But what we see then over the ensuing 15 years is this issue that had been so outside, not just the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party, through the efforts of ACT UP, through the efforts of the social movement, they put it on the national agenda. And so fast forward 15 years to look at George W. Bush, who is in many ways Reagan's disciple, who stuns the world in his State of the Union address in 2003 by promising and then delivering massive amounts of money to fight AIDS on a global scale. I mean, it's a remarkable change from literally laughing this thing out of the room in the 80s to two decades later proposing a huge and an incredibly successful program to fight it. And so that shows the way in which, despite the appearance of kind of a conservative dominance. There are always counterpoints here, and that's a big theme of the book, are the way in which social movements from the grassroots can really change things across the country, but especially in Washington.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Kevin Cruz, who joins us along with Julian Zelizer here in our Philadelphia studios, talking about their new book called Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974, both professors at Princeton University. And the book is based on a class that they have co-created at Princeton University. Well, we are marching inevitably towards President Trump, and let's talk about him. But let me just give out that phone number again, and we've got some comments as well. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Julian, we've been talking since the 1970s. How do you put Trump into this matrix?
He is a consequence of everything we wrote about. And we like to say that we wrote this book it finished most of the book before Trump was ever nominated, before it was even conceivable to either of us that Donald Trump would be the nominee or the president of the United States. And so the environment of politics that currently exists was there. It had been building. That's part of our story. In our part of Obama, we have on the birther movement and the media ecosystem that supported that. And so I think Donald Trump understood in some ways, maybe instinctively, maybe that's just where he came from, what the new era of politics actually looked like. And I think he obviously does things that another Republican wouldn't do in terms of his rhetoric, in terms of some of the strains on institutions. But he does fit this era. And look, his basic strategy is a strategy to play to partisanship. He embraces partisanship. He speaks to the conservative media almost exclusively. He plays to the quote-unquote base, which is really the Republican electorate, and make sure they're still on his same page. And so he might read – I don't know if he's going to read our book.
I don't think he will read books,
but if he did, there's an element I think that would actually resonate with how he sees the political world. He might not see it as a bad thing, but I think that's how you understand him. So it shouldn't be a total surprise that this is where – we ended up.
Well, let's talk about the federal government shutdown. 800,000 people, Kevin, who have been affected by this. Some are essentially forced to work without pay. Others are furloughed. We're learning that if you work for the government, you're not a millionaire. I think the median salary is something like $50,000 a year. So people are living paycheck to paycheck. The president said he owned this. He was happily willing to shut the government down. And he told us when he ran for president, only I can fix this. Where do we stand today?
Well, apparently only he can break it too. And so what we've seen here is it's in a lot of ways this shutdown is not surprising. And not only in that he announced he was going to do it, but he's been talking about this for the better part of a year or so that he's going to finally shut the government down over this. It is a little remarkable that the shutdown comes right after a midterm election when he ran on the wall and the Republicans got hammered in the House. They lost 40 seats on this. I'm trying to imagine, had Obama had we not had Obamacare passed in 2010, and Obama had campaigned hard on that in the 2010 midterms, and had then the Tea Party sweep come about, and then Obama said, "Well, I'm going to declare a national emergency unless John Boehner funds Obamacare," that would have been a little weird.
Yeah, but that's what we're talking about.
But I think the important thing to take away from this isn't really maybe what the president has done with politics. That seems almost
inevitable. That's his modus operandi.
But it's really the way in which the press has responded to this. You've got the president on video saying, "I own this alone. I will not blame Democrats. This is me." And yet we're seeing from some corners of the media the traditional response of both sides are to blame here, right? That this is Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump. They're equally to blame for this, which is ridiculous when you've got the president, I think, on tape, saying this is mine and my responsibility alone.
But what you have both described coming to this point is that the Republicans are very good at reframing or framing issues that benefit themselves.
Well, they're good at that, and they do have, I would argue, a stronger media world through which to sell that message. But in the Senate, and in the House, you're talking about a generation of Republicans who have come of age using pretty extreme tactics to pursue partisan objectives. So we talk about the shutdown of 95 and 96, Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House. And at the time, that was a pretty big thing to do, to let the government sit idly while they disputed Medicare funding. And we've seen shutdowns several times since then, including under President Obama. And it's become a normalized tool. Tea Party Republicans also were willing to use the threat of not raising the debt ceiling as a tactic of negotiation. And so if you're looking at it from the perspective of Capitol Hill, Mitch McConnell, Mark Meadows, and others, they've seen this. This is not the most radical thing to do. And the way it's more extreme than before is, the president using it to get something new. All the other budget disputes were about defending existing programs. Oh, this is about, I'm going to legislate by not opening the government. That's where the move is bold. And at the same time, there's no urgency to solve it. In 95, 96, everything shut down, not just the government, but all other issues. Everyone was negotiating. There was an intensity and sense of urgency. Where today, I don't think there's anything going on behind the scenes. I think everyone's kind of waiting for someone to figure out an outcome. And that's how something that has become routine becomes even more extreme in 2019.
And meanwhile, you've got people in food lines who work for the government but don't have enough money or food, Kevin, to make it to the next
day. It's a remarkable thing. You talk about the people are, you know, they're not living paycheck to paycheck because there's nothing in those paychecks. They're trying to find a way to live without them. And we're getting reports now of not just federal workers standing in line to make ends meet at a food bank. But air traffic controllers who are driving Ubers to try to feed their family, I mean, that doesn't fill me with a lot of confidence about what's going on in the airport. So.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We got a lot of folks that want to join us as well. And again, Kevin Cruz, Julian Zelizer, our guests here in our Philadelphia studio, talking about their new book, Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Kevin Cruz. He's a professor of history at Princeton University, and Julian Zelizer, also a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian is a CNN political analyst and co-host of the podcast Politics and Polls, and again talking about their new book, Fault Lines. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can text us, and you can put a message on our Facebook page as well. Let me read a couple of comments here. An email from Joe. Can your guest comment on whether the Electoral College and its enabling of the election of a president with less than a majority of the popular vote exacerbates divisiveness in our political discourse? Julian, you're nodding your head.
Well, for sure it does, and this is not the first time. The 2000 election is one of our favorite parts of the book to write about, and the outcome there, where the victor won by a few hundred contested votes, really poisoned the well for the administration in many ways. And it heals a little bit politically after 9/11. But the animosity and anger of what the Electoral College can do in terms of that discrepancy doesn't go away. So to have a non-majoritarian system that way doesn't make things better. That said, I don't think either of us are predicting any big reform on the horizon.
No. And that bubbles up every 4 years, mm-hmm. and then it kind of bubbles away. A question from Jerry for you, Kevin. Will saving DACA be enough to sway the Democrats? And there is this several offers on the table. One is the wall at $7 billion for DACA, whether it's 3 years or permanent. But if compromise is the goal, how do you see that those offers?
I don't think they're going to work. Again, I'm an historian. My professional training is in hindsight, so I'm out on a ledge here making predictions. But I don't think they're going to do that, largely because what's being proposed is something that Trump himself took away, and it's being proposed on a temporary basis. And we're learning now that there are some poison pills in this so-called compromise position, which is really a compromise worked out between Trump and other Republicans, such as that Central American children can't apply for asylum at the border as they always have. They instead have to go to some kind of central site in Central America first to apply for asylum there. I think that's going to be a non-starter. I think we're really going to see the Democrats hold fast on this. And the polling is largely on their side. Yeah. I think, again, the fact that President Trump said he deserved blame for the shutdown, well, people are blaming him for the shutdown. And I don't think that's going to change. And as long as that's the case, I think the Democrats will probably hold tight.
So far.
I mean, yeah. I think ahead, a bolder immigration proposal, which wasn't coming from the president, could be tempting. Some kind of permanent fix to this without exemptions and loopholes, some kind of path to citizenship for everyone else who is now living here for years. That would be enticing. The problem is House Republicans are not going to go for that. And back to the book, that is a theme of the last 10 years, this hardline anti-immigration attitude and position really taking hold. I don't think the president really has that kind of wiggle room in the House of Representatives and even in parts of the Senate Republican caucus. So it's a mediocre offer that I can't imagine getting much better because of where the GOP is on this issue.
Here's a tweet from Thomas. Any perspectives on the election to the House of young freshmen and women, we should say, as Ocasio-Cortez, who may turn the tables on the current political situation? Much has been made of her and some of these other young, largely women who have been elected to office, Julian.
Well, we start the book with a class that's comparable. That's the class of 74. They come in, they're mad, they're angry, they are determined to shake up the status quo, and they do a lot of things in the 70s. They literally depose several powerful senior committee chairs who assumed they had lifetime security in their jobs. They push some of the reforms we've discussed to try to clean up the political process and introduce new issues on the economy and on foreign policy. In the end, though, some of their efforts were subverted. Some of their own energy wore out as they became senior members or more senior members and turned to preservation over that initial impetus. But they shouldn't be discounted. And they also will introduce new ways of doing business. The class of 74 and those who followed, they were more media savvy than it was television. They also refused to accept some of the old norms of how Congress worked. First-year members and new members had a lot more of a role in decision-making. And I assume some of that's going to happen in ways that do permanently change the institution.
We were talking during the break, Kevin, about Ocasio-Cortez and her, you know, Where's Mitch?
Right.
She and some other members of the freshman class on a hunt to find the Senate Majority Leader. I don't know if they ever found him or not, but nonetheless, she tweeted it out and hashtags and all that. You're a well-known use of Twitter.
Right.
How do you see that?
Well, I think she's brilliant at the form. I mean, she really does understand the way in which it works. She's a kind of a master to the clapback culture of Twitter, so to speak. For some reason, all of these conservative figures keep trying to come after her, and all she does is make them look ridiculous, but then amplify her own message. I mean, the fact that she has got the country talking about raising the top marginal tax rate to 70%, the way it had been before Reagan, is remarkable. I mean, it really and polls are showing that actually most of the public is fine with that, even large percentages of Republicans. So I think she's doing a great job in challenging the orthodoxies that I think an older generation of Democrats who had come of age during the Reagan Revolution never would have pushed on this. They would have seen it as political suicide. She either is accurately reading the moment or simply isn't aware of this past history. I suspect it's the former, and she realizes it's time to take it on. But she's been incredibly effective.
Well, how do you then compare her use of Twitter and the president's?
Well, the president uses Twitter really to, rally his base. And Ocasio-Cortez does that to some degree, but she's much shrewder about it. The president uses it.
She doesn't have misspellings.
Doesn't have misspellings, right? Right. Which is amazing, given the fact that so many on the right are criticizing her for not being, well-versed about the ins and outs of federal laws before she was even sworn in. She may have a better command of them than the president, I suspect. But she uses it in a way in which she does rally the base. She does do that. But I think she is much more effective in getting those ideas out into the general public and really pushing the conversation in a way in which the president's tweets actually tend to work in reverse. They tend to slam the door on conversations and they draw people into their corners. She has the opposite effect.
What do you think?
I would add the president also uses Twitter not just for his base but to get the media's attention and to shape the media narrative. And that's where he's been effective. He understands you can inject something in a media system that constantly needs content. And it's very hard for the best reporters, the best journalists to resist that. So I think it's actually been quite effective. What's really interesting in addition to her is Speaker Pelosi, who in some ways is going to a different style. She doesn't care about the media. She's doing hardball legislative politics. And she's in some ways responding to what she's seen from the Republican Party, meaning we will use the processes, we will use the institutions, and we will use them to fight the president. And she's been pretty ruthless in the last few weeks, and she's not giving in very easily. So there's two parts of the Democratic Party working different styles, different strategies. I mean, the question is if they run into each other at some point. Because she doesn't want to tweet, really.
Well, she's the one who said, I don't think you should give your State of the Union address because we won't have the security that we need in order to ensure that you and I guess the rest of us would be safe.
And the shutdown. She is not responding to his speech the other day. And they have the power of the purse and they will hold out until he reopens the government to negotiate.
Do you think the president is afraid of her? And I ask that he has criticized her, but he has not talked about her appearance or her age or anything any of the kind of really personal critiques, Kevin, that he has lodged at his opponents.
I don't want to psychoanalyze, but I do think that you can look at the evidence and the way in which he treats all of his other critics is to mock them, to mock their appearance, to give them a nickname. So Elizabeth Warren is Pocahontas or Schumer is Crying Chuck Schumer. Excuse me. There's no nickname for Nancy Pelosi. There's no mockery of her. I think he does realize what he's up against.
Yeah.
And he's scared. There's an investigation going on. He does realize at some basic level she has a lot of power now to decide how that investigation unfolds from the congressional wing. And there's a part of him who's been fighting his whole career in different venues who understands those kinds of threats.
Yeah. Well, let me pick up on this. And again, this is something we were talking about before going on the air. I had interviewed, as a lot of people did, David K. Johnston. He was the Philadelphia Inquirer's bureau chief for Atlantic City when Donald Trump was then building his four casinos there. And having interviewed David K. Johnston, it's from his perspective, the kind of dysfunction that we're seeing in the White House is essentially how Donald Trump ran his casino business. There was dysfunction. There was bankruptcy. There was bailout. There was a lot of ego, all of that. Julian, do you see some parallels here? And does that say that we are in a different kind of political dysfunction because of how the president has run his businesses over the years?
Yes, for sure. I don't think there's any line from the time he stepped in the White House in terms of style with how he leads. There's two other parts of who Trump was. He was very media focused, and a big part of his career was The Apprentice too. Always thinking of image, always thinking of how things play in terms of where people see events, and I think that has continued. He also was not known as the cleanest business person, and he didn't believe in clear ethical lines that some other people in the business community do. And I think that is potentially a great danger to the country and certainly to his own presidency.
You both had a piece in The Atlantic earlier this month, Worse Than Watergate. So we talked a little bit about Richard Nixon. How do you, Kevin, see these two presidents?
Well, we've been making this comparison a lot lately, not just us, but I think the country as a whole. But there are a lot of real echoes there. I mean, if you look at the underlying facts of what the allegations with Russia are, it's basically a break-in to get information out of a Democratic National Committee. That sounds familiar, right? But it's on such a much bigger scale than what happened in Watergate. This is not a couple burglars jimmying open a file cabinet. This is, if the theories are correct, involves international actors, involves foreign powers, involves – a great deal of crimes. And in terms of the larger scale, it's really remarkable. But it's not just to compare the presidents. I think we have to contrast the settings around them. And so one of the things that I think is keeping President Trump afloat in the way in which Nixon would not have is the fact that the partisanship is so pronounced that you've got many Republicans still in his corner. They were in Nixon's corner, too. Even through resignation, a full quarter of the country still approves of President Nixon post-resignation. But the media is the big difference here. Had we had a Fox News and a Breitbart and all of that, the conservative voices on Twitter, had we had that with Nixon, I think he might have actually survived. I think he would have been propped up because there would have been people when the smoking gun tape came out who said, oh, that's old news, or it's not a big deal, or that's not a crime. Is breaking in or even a crime? We would have had all those arguments. You know, there would have been a young Rudy Giuliani back then making those same arguments.
Well, probably. I'm glad you raised because he was all over the talk shows, and Julian saying on Sunday that Trump was involved with business deals with Russia into either October, November 2016, obviously when he was elected president. Of course, candidate Trump denied that there was any kind of business dealings going on. And now here we are with Giuliani saying, well, I was just kind of imagining a conversation. Where does that take us?
Yeah, he's definitely one of the most unusual figures in Trump world, and you might not even need a congressional investigation. You just keep letting him go on TV. And so I always go back and forth between one thing is to say, well, maybe there's just no strategy. The president isn't even paying attention. He just puts people out who can't control the narrative. The other issue I often think about is maybe they're just giving us everything or letting Giuliani
say everything. Kitchen sink, in a way?
Kitchen sink or smoking gun, meaning back to Nixon, there was a smoking gun that eventually shocked us. We heard the tape, or Congress heard the tape, of the president ordering obstruction of justice, whereas the president, Giuliani, they just say everything. It's hard to imagine a smoking gun beyond anything Giuliani has said. He walks it back, but he said it. And so if there's a strategy, my guess is that's it. Say everything so the shock of any particular nugget from the Mueller report or from a congressional investigation, which we still don't have, won't be quite as substantial.
At the end of Bob Woodward's book, he quotes President Trump's lawyer, whose name Dowd, who says he wouldn't put him on the stand because he'd end up in an orange jumpsuit, saying he was basically a liar.
Right.
So we're almost out of time here, but Kevin, I'm looking at you, and we know the Washington Post has been tracking the misstatements coming from the president. I think we're at 8,000 now. Mm-hmm. How does that fit into your thesis?
Well, I think back then with Nixon, people were really shocked that a president would lie. They were shocked that the president would use a foul language. You know, when those transcripts came out, everyone was joking about what does the expletive deleted mean, right? You know, try to fill it in. Well, it's not deleted anymore. You know, we've heard the Access Hollywood tape. We've heard the president curse. We've definitely seen the president lie in real time. The fact checkers keep checking the facts, but I'm not sure what difference it makes. Yeah. There are a lot of people who are fine with him lying.
Our public square has been eroded, I would say, and it's not simply him. Again, we have seen this with social media, with the way in which a lot of public debates have been had, where truth is no longer a priority or a necessity. And the president understands that. He plays right into that. And I think it should become clear by now that that has been a substantial problem. It is a big problem we face as a democracy, not simply with this presidency.
Well, we have to leave it there. We could go on. The clock tells me we are out of time. My thanks to both of you, Kevin Cruz, Julian Zelizer, for coming in and joining us on Radio Times.
Great thanks for here. Having us.
You're very welcome. And again, their book is called Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. And both of our guests are professors at Princeton University. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, sign up for our Facebook group as well, and many ways to stay in touch with us. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and John Ahrens. And we welcome our new Radio Times producer, Kelsey Hansen. Our thanks to Alex Stern for helping us out today as well. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.